painting to photography, from beadwork to woodworking, KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University presents Artbeat. Artbeat highlights the work and accomplishments of local artists from in and around Winona. Support for Artbeat is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Now, here's Terry Tenseth with today's Artbeat.
Today on Artbeat, we feature a real character. This individual has been an acting company member of the Great River Shakespeare Festival for 6 seasons. Today he will fill us in on how he became an actor, hard lessons learned along the way, and much more. You're listening to Artbeat.
My name is Chris Mixon. I'm an actor with the Great River Shakespeare Festival.
How many years now at the festival?
It's my 5th season out of the last 6 years. I was here last year, and then the year before that, I had a show in New York, and I couldn't make it out for the season. Fortunately, they hired me back.
They let you back? They forgave
they
you?
They forgave me.
Great. Well, let's start at the beginning. Where are you from originally?
I grew up outside of Atlanta. All my family is from Georgia.
Okay.
We go way back from the 1802 land lottery, apparently, from, you know, everybody's doing their genealogy now. So.
Oh, yeah, it's a big thing.
Yeah, it's a big thing. So all my family's been from Georgia for years.
Did you ever do the Jekyll Island, Georgia theater thing?
No. Actually, by the time I left Georgia for college, I didn't know I was going to go into theater as a major, so.
Let's talk about that.
Okay.
The road to theater.
The road to theater. I left. Actually, we moved from Georgia when my father was transferred. My senior year in high school, I lived in South Carolina for a short while till I graduated. And then I went to a small college in North Carolina called Warren Wilson College, which is a small liberal arts college there in the mountains of West North Carolina in Asheville. And it was very small, 500 students, very small liberal arts college where they had a work study program and a farm. And it was wonderful. It was really terrific. And they had a little theater there, like a 300 seat proscenium theater with no budget. And so I was there my first semester, and they had this young director from New York who had come in and directed this production of Our Town. And it was amazing. I thought, this is what I want to do. And they didn't really have a theater major. So I had to do like an English fine arts double major with a concentration in theater and just get an English degree with a fine arts double major. But, I worked in that theater for 4 years. The students did everything. We had no budget. We had like $2,000 a year, I think, was the entire theater's budget. But because it was a work study program, you work for room and board. And I just worked in the theater all the time, and that was my work study. So I sort of maintained the theater, and we did light. You did lights. You cleaned toilets. You directed plays. You acted in the plays. You know, it was really terrific.
You acted in the plays while cleaning toilets.
They actually stole that idea for, you know, the first season of Slings and Arrows. You know, when he's holding the plunger and doing the speech front. That was doing the Hamlet speech. That was completely. Take it stolen from me. It was not really, but I've done that. Practiced my Hamlet speech while plunging a toilet.
You know, anytime you can get a little bit of practice in, right? A rehearsal.
Exactly.
Right. So what happened after those 4 years?
Well, because it wasn't a theater major, you know, I really wanted to go and find out if I was even doing it right, because we were producing plays, but who knows if our True West was even close to what True West should be produced as. And we did Measure for Measure, and it was a very interesting production, but, you know, was it, you know what I mean? Uh-huh. So we just didn't know if we were, I didn't know if I was even doing it right. And so I wanted to go where the competition was and where I would learn more about acting. I did a year's internship with the Cincinnati Playhouse in the Park, which was a very big regional theater with a very small intern company. So I was very lucky to get into it. And we did live improvisation on the weekends at a local pub and understudied all the equity actors on stage. And we cleaned toilets and, you know, did all the stuff that the theater needed done that they couldn't afford to pay anybody to do, or didn't have to pay anybody to do because they had this intern company. And then I went to Rutgers and got my graduate degree there, and that was closer to New York, and mm-hmm. had a very prominent sort of acting master's program. So I went there and then segued into New York after that.
So it seems like it could be very frightening going from the four-year experience to the master's and trying to figure out, what have I done the last X amount of years?
Right. Well, yeah, I got to New York a lot later than a lot of actors do. I think I was almost 29 by the time I got to New York. But I was glad to be at a big university with a real conservatory, because then I really learned what I was doing wrong and what I needed to do right in terms of developing a technique as an actor. And I never really looked back on it with any kind of regret, except most of the people who came out of Rutgers when they were younger did a little better, just because they were a little bit younger when they went to New York. Calista Flockhart, Kristen Davis, you know, were both at Rutgers about the same time that I was. And I think because they were undergraduates getting the same training, by the time you reach 28, 29 years old and go into New York, particularly as a young character man, you know, there just was a lot of us. And there were a lot of ingenues when Kristen and Calista went in. They just had this incredible conservatory training, and they were just, you know, really wonderful actors hitting the market with real technique, and so they did very well, besides being incredibly gorgeous creatures as they are too.
Who is that? were you really off base when you got there, when you were going through the specialized training,
or when I got to Rutgers?
Yeah,
I think so. You know, I was, you know, I had a native talent, they told me, and others had told me that I had a native talent as an actor. I just didn't have a technique. A good school will teach you a technique, and a technique simply is being able to do the same thing twice or improving upon it each time that you do it. You know the truth of the moment, and you know how to play an action, and that's part of technique. But then trusting yourself to play it as if it's you're playing it for the first time, but always doing it so that you're always in your light and you always cue your acting partner. And in the same way, you know, you're not sort of wandering off into this unknown land in your mind because you don't know what you're doing. And so that's what I wanted, was just okay, I accept that I have a native talent. Now I want to learn how to use it. I think that's what a good conservatory does. Some people never go to a conservatory. I have actor friends who have amazing technique who never got a degree, and they just learned it by doing it, you know. And I think those are two ways to do it. I wanted to have a technique before I got to New York, so I didn't blow any auditions because I didn't know what I was doing.
Frightening.
Yeah, it's scary, but it's exciting. It's very exciting. You know?
So after you get your master's, you go to New York. What was your first show?
My first show, well, because I had been an intern at Cincinnati before grad school, sort of, and it was a 3-year grad program at Rutgers. By the end of my second year, I got offered an equity job at a local theater, a place called the George Street Theater, which is in New Brunswick. It's a equity theater. And it was the end of my second year, and it went into the summer, so I was able to do it before I finished up. So I had my equity card when I went to New York.
Okay.
As a bonus of having taken that year off between undergrad and grad and doing that internship for a year, I made some friends, and they offered me my equity card. So, but then when I went into New York, I was recommended for a job where it paid like $125 a week under an equity contract, and I had to sign on as an assistant stage manager. And it was a production of Cyrano de Bergerac that they were doing at the major borough parks. So they did about 10 performances, each one in a different park in and around the 5 boroughs of New York City. And I had to show up like 2-3 hours early, build the set, basically put all the platforms and all the scenery together. And then all the other actors showed up, and then we did Cyrano, which was like a 3.5-hour show. And then I had to stay for 2 hours after and break everything down and load it back up into the U-Hauls and get it back out to Queens in the parking space that we were renting to store our goods.
Glamorous.
And we had no lights, fortunately, which meant that we had to do it, you know, do the show during the day. The city was paying us to do free Shakespeare, free Cyrano. And so we had to do it in broad daylight, which was just, you know, it's like outside today. It's 91 degrees. It gets that hot in New York City. So we were pretty warm in those musketeer outfits, which are like 40-pound costumes. And so it was a long day. But fortunately, we only did like two, after the rehearsal period, maybe two performances a week. So it wasn't, you know, but those were two very hard days, you know, of all day in the heat setting up. But it was great. It was, you know, I was young and I loved it. I was doing what I wanted to do. I wasn't making a lot of money, but it, you know, I got my equity weeks towards my health insurance right out of the gate going into New York. So it was good.
So you kind of got with a union right away. Do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, by the time you're 28 or 29, it's a good idea.
Okay.
You know, because I had a resume that I could show to people. And if I had an equity card, by then you can seek equity work. The problem is finding a producer that, if they can hire a non-equity person,
right,
who's the same age. And every young actor goes through that. You know, do I become equity now or do I stay non-equity and build my resume and get some good roles on my resume? And depending on the producer and, you know, whether that producer can hire non-equity or hire equity, it's one of those crossroads that you reach, you know, in your professional development. I was glad I did it when I did. I worked a little bit less for a few years, but then once I started to make friends and get offered jobs, I think I've never been with a year without any work. I always told myself if I went a year and a half and didn't get any work as an actor, I would find something else to do, you know, because I thought that would be the signal, you know, the sign that, you know, this business is not for me. I always was lucky enough to work and keep with it.
That is lucky.
It's lucky. It's lucky for like building a pension and getting your health insurance. As far as an income is concerned, it's, you know, it's, you know, in a good year, $15,000 or $20,000 as an actor. That's a pretty good year. But by even the standards of the 1980s, 1990s, into the 2000s, that's not a lot of
money. Especially out east.
Yes, yeah. Especially in New York City. And New York City's gotten a lot more expensive since 1999. I lived in New York and never paid over $400 a month in rent. I was sharing a lot, but now you can't do a share now and not expect to pay $1,000 a month as your portion of
right.
a rent for a 2 or 3 bedroom apartment, you know, so it's a lot more expensive now. I left in 1999, never, you know, having paid more than $400 or $500 a month. And I came back in 2006 and I was like, really? That's extraordinary. Who can afford to pay that? And, you know, and the salaries haven't gone up. So
right.
they're just the rents. So it's heavy duty for young actors now.
What were you doing between 96 and 99?
I left in 99 because a resident company like Great River, but year-round in Alabama, the Alabama Shakespeare Festival, had a resident company. It was 10 years after I'd gotten out of grad school, so I was in my late 30s. And they hired me on to do a new play down there about the death of Abe Lincoln, a comedy. It was funny.
Oh.
The first act's comedy, and then he gets shot, and then it gets you know, it's kind of hard to
right.
hard to keep the comedy up after that. But no, it was a very interesting play, and they have a 6 month contract, so they hired me, and I went down and I did like a Shakespeare and that play, which was called Sockdology. And they asked me to stay on as a resident company actor, so I stayed there for 7.5 seasons.
Wow,
you know, from 99 to the end of 2006. As a resident company member, I did 34 plays. I forget how many. It's like 34, 36 plays, half of which were directed by new directors that I hadn't worked with that are still my friends even to this day and hire me to do plays in other areas. And it was a great experience. And then they changed artistic directors and eliminated the resident company, so we moved back to New York in 2006.
Okay.
But I've worked with the Denver Center, with Great River, other resident companies. I'm a member now of a resident company in New York called the Pearl Theater Company, which is an off-Broadway resident company. They're in their 29th season. They have a company of about 10 actors, and I'm thrilled to be actually in a resident company in Manhattan.
That's so very fortunate. Yeah.
This doesn't exist.
I
can't even believe I'm a part of it. And they're a great company. They're a really great company.
So are you a character actor or where do you put yourself?
Yeah, it's a character actor. I think coming out of graduate school, I was considered a young lead, but I was always really just not quite tall enough or not quite good looking enough to be necessarily a Romeo or a Hamlet or something like that. So I didn't have as much luck in Manhattan because the market is just, I mean,
oh, yeah.
You know,
brutal.
If you need a guy who's 5'10 instead of 5'9, you got your hand, you know, it's just, it's very competitive. But I ended up doing mostly character stuff on the side. If people were doing showcases and they knew I could be funny, then they would hire me to be their funny character guy, and somebody in the audience would be like, "Oh, you know, I've got a play that's a comedy. Would you want to be involved with it? Doesn't pay anything." And at that time in New York, I was really wasn't about the money. It was about just working all the time, because it's always better to be working than not working, no matter if you're getting paid for it or not. You know, so if you've got something that you can communicate to agents. And I didn't have an agent for the first 2 years that I was in New York, so I didn't have anything to lose. Because, as I said, when I got in at 28 or 29, every agency had probably 10 guys that looked exactly like me. So they couldn't even get work for their own guys. So I just wanted them to always know that I was working all these agencies. And finally, one of them said, "You know what? We want to sign you, but we think you're a character man." The manager that I was working with at the time thought of me as a leading type. So they said, "Is this going to be a conflict? Because we don't want to be fighting with your manager all the time, because she thinks you should be doing, you know, Romeo or Hamlet, and we think you should be playing Dromio and Speed and all of these wonderful young character roles." And I said, "You let me handle my manager. You submit me for what you want. She'll call you about what she wants, and I think the world will be rosy, one way or the other." And it was, and you know, I kept both an agent and a manager for about the first 10 years that I was there. And then when I went to Alabama, I didn't need both of them. If I was going to be a resident company member. And my wife and I had a son, and, you know, the extra commission was a little, you know, we just needed to save money. And so, and my manager understood, and she was getting ready to retire. So it all worked out.
Excellent.
Yeah, yeah. Cool.
So is it always Shakespeare, or is there like a shakeup in there somewhere?
It's a lot of Shakespeare. I do a lot of, I think if you know a character man who speaks Shakespeare and can make it funny, can make those, because a lot of those funny scenes just kind of lay there. And I just seem to have a knack for my own interpretation of a lot of those comic scenes so that I could get a laugh one way or the other, you know, no matter how obscure the language was. But I didn't really set out to do Shakespeare. I stayed up late reading Harold Bloom and thinking Shakespeare is my life. I was never really like that. I love Alan Ayckbourn and so many funny plays and serious plays. But it just always seemed like Shakespeare was something that people hired me to do. And show business, I think, has a way of putting you where you need to be. And for some reason, that just was where I needed to be. It was on stage instead of in front of a camera and doing comedies mostly instead of more dramas. And I've always wanted to be employed, so I've enjoyed it.
Have you been the person that always wants to get a laugh in life?
I was for a long time as a kid.
Okay.
I was a real class clown. When I hit my teenage years, I got very serious, because that's what you do when you're a teenager. You start thinking about things that are deeper than making the classroom crack up when the teacher doesn't want them to. And then when I became an actor, I wanted to be a very serious actor. So I kind of left my clownage behind. And then when I got into college and to grad school, people just were like, you should be funny.
You're a funny guy.
You should be funnier. Okay. And they sort of gave me permission. And I just found that actually a lot of that groundwork in doing really serious stuff pays off with comedy, you know, as the more serious the character takes it, the funnier it becomes. Like Barney Fife is always very serious about everything he does. Tim Conway, really, except for those guys cracking up on Carol Burnett all the time, he was a very straight-faced actor. It served me, I think, taking myself very seriously. And it complete works. My character has this emotional breakdown.
Yeah.
And if you don't play it for keeps, I don't think it's as funny.
You got to commit.
Yeah.
You really That's what you're saying. You got to commit. You got to write it the
you
whole
gotta
way.
You got to commit to Lulu.
Did you watch a lot of Carol Burnett? I mean, was that a big influence?
I think I was just in that crossover period where when I was 18 or 19, HBO had just come out, the whole concept of cable. You know, before that, there were only four channels. So everybody watched Carol Burnett because it was, you know, it was prime time. The thing that I've been really passionate about is going back and looking at like the things that predated me, like Sid Caesar and his crew of actors. And I've just watched that two episode documentary on Woody Allen, which is phenomenal. Buster Keaton, a lot of that stuff I really love to watch and get ideas from.
When you are given a role, how do you approach it? Do you read the heck out of it and just make notes? Like, well, maybe I want to do this, or psychologically he's coming from here. Like, how do you begin carving?
So much of it depends on what the when you get into the rehearsal hall and start to work with the director. So I like to read the play, and let it just kind of resonate, let some ideas kind of flow in terms of physicality. Or what I try to be clear about is what is the character's journey from the beginning of the play to the end of the play. What do I think that is? But how I get from point A to point Z will depend a lot on you know, what's the world of the play? What's the costume design going to be? What's the director's vision going to be? So I don't want to marry myself to any ideas that when I get into the rehearsal hall is going to clash with the director. And I think the older I get, the more I understand that. I think when I was just out of the gate, out of grad school, I thought it was my responsibility to come in with a lot of solid ideas and fight for them with the director. And you just find out very soon that you don't want to fight with the director. He's your best friend. So if you get at odds with him, he will, or her, you know, they will naturally put their attention towards somebody who's a little bit more amenable in the rehearsal hall. So even if you don't agree with what the concept that he wants, don't let your ego get in the way of learning something and doing something else that is equally, if not more, brilliant. Just be patient, read the play, let it resonate, and then get in the rehearsal hall and work really hard the first week or two to try and collaborate to make this vision, this collaborative vision, kind of come true. So I try not to do too much work now. Just read the play and make sure that I'm familiar enough and I've got a couple of ideas. Because a lot of my work now comes from not having to audition for it. And that's a product of the times, I think, as well. You know, so many theaters are cutting back and not spending the money to fly to New York and rent a rehearsal hall and pay a casting director and then see new actors, which is a blessing and a curse. The blessing being that now they call me directly and say, I'm doing this next year. Can you do it? And you sign on and then you fill your calendar up, you know, that way. And that's a gift.
That's
as an actor.
Awesome.
That's awesome. And you only need, you know, one or two or three theaters that you're affiliated with to do that. And you can fill up your calendar for the upcoming year, you know, very, very easily. But then if you're a younger actor and you're trying to get to know people and trying to work, you know, that audition process has been kind of cut way back. And so a lot of actors, young actors, are having trouble meeting directors because they can't get an audition. They either have to travel to the theater or wait a long time for that theater to come to New York. And there's very little coming out on breakdowns, you know, where they plan to do, you can't take it with you, and they're going to cast all 12 people by going into New York and auditioning all those roles. They may cast everything from their files and maybe one or two specialty roles that they have that they want to fill in a particular way, either by diversifying it ethnically or they just need somebody who's in their 70s or 80s to play it, and they need to go and find somebody who can do that or is still in the business, or, you know what I mean, and traveling. You know, a lot of people that get to that age, they don't want to travel to the region
right.
anymore, you know. So unless it's something very specialized, or a child actor, they need somebody who's 12 to play in The Miracle Worker. They just need a very gifted young actress to play that. Something like that. So it's interesting the way that the business changes.
Right. Economy definitely drives that.
It drives it, yeah. And so now I'm knowing much further in advance what my roles are going to be. And then I can read those parts. But then I just have to kind of set it aside until I get to the theater, get in the rehearsal hall, and then just sort of give my first few ideas, if it's a vocal quality that the character has, or, you know, a lisp or something that makes whatever the character is, if it's Ague Cheek or Dogberry or somebody, you know, give it something. But even then, you know, you make a choice like that and you find out they're doing the play in outer space and you go, oh, well, that idea is too classically Shakespearean for this concept. I try not to marry myself to anything right away.
No, makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What's been some of the hardest lessons you've learned in your career?
I think it's all about the ego. You know, you just can't let your ego get away with you. When I was on a national tour, I had going from theater to theater to theater can be very frustrating. And I learned a big lesson. It was a Broadway tour. You travel with sort of a core group of people who run all the crews, the props, the electronics, automation, lights, sound. You travel with like those, the conductor, the assistant conductor. But basically, once you get to Baltimore or Denver or wherever, everybody else is local hire, you know, all of the stagehands and all of the orchestra people. And a lot of that is you arrive with the actors. And sometimes they have to learn in a day everything that's going to happen on the stage, and whether or not they need to hold a curtain for an actor who's coming leaping off the stage. And I had been one of those actors where, you know, I had to run through at the end of a musical number and leap like a gazelle into the wings. And a local stagehand was supposed to always have that curtain open right at that point. And that's, you know, one of the tough things to negotiate, because you don't know these guys and it's Tuesday night and you just arrived and you come leaping out. Anyway, one of the props guys that was traveling with us, I could always hand off this box full of stuff that I had to run across the stage, hand it off to him. And one time I leaped off the stage, leaping off the stage, the curtain wasn't draped. I ran right into the curtain. I fell. I got up. I was mad, and I shoved this box into the chest of the guy that I always did that handoff with, who's the guy that I travel with, who should be, you know, he's my friend. And this friend of mine from that point on, and this is just sort of a union thing. It's like, you know, actors and stagehands can have a great relationship, but if you breach that relationship, and I didn't realize at that time that that handoff was something that he was doing that he did not have to do.
Oh.
And I lost my cool. And from that point on, for the rest of the tour, for 9 months, I had to come off the stage and set the box on the floor right next to him. And then he would pick it up and take it off. And it was just like one of those things that for a while I was like, you know, really, Bob, you don't have to be, you know, don't be a jerk about this. It was an event. But for him, it's a precedent. And then he had been in the business longer than I had. And he made it clear that this doesn't affect our friendship, but that's not going to happen again. And so, you know, I had to walk away and going, you know what, you just got to keep your ego in check. This thing is collaborative from the get-go, because you're a performer. You are not any more special than a stagehand. You are not, you know, than that local guy who learned that he was supposed to dress a curtain in like 2 seconds and he didn't do it. And somebody could have gotten hurt. And it's like, that was a big lesson. It was a hard lesson, but it was a good one. It's one of those that you learn coming up, that hopefully you learn it coming up, and you don't kind of go into later years not learning that. Because,
right,
you know, if your ego doesn't get in the way of creating something brilliant, then you will truly create something brilliant. But you just, it's, every show is a lesson in how not to get a, let your, it, it's a collaborative art form. You can't let your ego be or feel more important than anybody else's. And it's hard. It's the hardest art form, because it does require everybody to be involved collaboratively.
Yeah. There's a lot of different personalities that dealing with.
Yeah. This company is extraordinary in how much we all get along and how much we all love each other. And if you've ever done a show at a place where nobody got along, it's just the hardest thing. And there's no way really to make it any better than it's going to be. So you have to, you know, your ego has to take a back step. You know, you have to say, okay, this is only going to be this good because I'm never going to get along with these people that I'm on stage with, but I have to get through this. So I have to negotiate on the backside of this. I have to do things that I don't like and I'm not happy with, so that I can get along with these people that I have less respect for than other places like Great River, where I just think everybody's brilliant. But it's chemistry. Sometimes your chemistry just doesn't match somebody else's, but you still have to collaborate.
Yeah, hard lessons to learn.
And it never stops. It's not like you reach like, well, I'm 50 now. I've learned all the lessons. Now let's see. This is card number 3. I have to put on this, you know, cap. It's never the same.
No. You know? What about embarrassing moments?
Embarrassing moments. Wow.
How do you recover?
I don't know. Well, fortunately, I'm a comedian. You know, I'm considered a comedian, so that the more embarrassing it is, the more, you know, true to form it is. Gosh, embarrassing moments. Like on the stage.
Yeah.
Like it's one time I was doing a production of Two Gentlemen, and I went to say something, and this thing came out of my mouth. It was sort of phlegmy and goopy, and it flew across the stage.
Oh man.
And the guy who was playing the Duke just hit him right on the cheek. And the audience, the entire, I mean, it was sort of like theater, a thrust theater scenario, very close. And so there wasn't a single audience member that missed this event that happened.
Oh, man.
And fortunately, we were sort of in three-piece suits, and we all had a little handkerchief in our coat pockets, and he was just able to reach into his pocket and wipe it off his face. But, you know, the audience was just, they were on the floor laughing about this. And after they were shocked and mortified by the event in terms of how we were going to deal with it, and then they released and laughed, and we just kept going on because neither of us could think of an ad lib that would rescue the moment.
A Shakespearean one at that.
Yes, at that. So stuff like that's pretty funny, you know. Complete Works now, what we're doing is where the costumes have to go on and off so fast, you know, there's always stuff like falling off in the middle of a scene, and you just have to, but that's sort of par for that chorus.
Yeah, how do you deal with improvisation in that piece? Because I know you have, there is a script.
Yes.
But it's kind of loose, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. It's actually structured very well, so that there's not as much improvisation as ad lib. That sort of fills, because it sort of says, okay, you pick somebody out of the audience and you bring them on the stage, and you know, you give them this dialogue. I mean, or you talk to them with these words. So it's scripted to that. But what you don't know is, we talked a lot about this in rehearsal, by the way. Improvisation versus ad-libbing versus the setup and the punchline that's written in the text, because it's so crisp the way that the script is written that you're kind of a fool to go off the text, because the text is so good, the jokes are so good. So it's better to stick with them, and then only ad-lib when you have to. When you pull somebody up on the stage who wants to be a little bit more animated or is completely terrified, you know, so you ad-lib to either comfort them or to reel them in so that you can get back on the text and accomplish what the text is setting out, which is to dissect Ophelia's id, ego, and superego by pulling people up on the stage and making them represent those things and stuff. So.
And that's fun for the audience,
yeah.
Too.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had anybody this year be completely terrified by that, or?
Some that are kind of terrified. And then some that haven't, but we've only done like 5 performances, so we're still learning it. We're still getting our sea legs with the show. But there have been some real characters that we pulled up. One woman was so funny. She just said something that just all 3 of us fell on the stage laughing. I mean, it was, and the audience just went, because it was so unexpected and so organic. And she was terrified. And we was like, you know, and at that moment, you're going to, and she said, throw up. And it just, everybody just went kaboom onto the, because it was just so, such a wonderful moment. So it's that kind of thing that we do kind of have to juggle the ad-libs until we can successfully get back on text, you know, and kind of pick it up.
See, there has to be a lot of trust between the 3 of you, mm-hmm. the 2 Chris's and
yeah.
Brian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, we talked very, very specifically and frankly about how that works. And comedy is so hard because you do have to negotiate with the other actors so directly. Something like Lear, everything funnels through the director. And Melissa Rain Anderson is a great director for comedy, so it was that way with Complete Works. But it's so much more about, if I turn my head, can you turn your head this way? Or I'm going to turn my head here. And that's directly actor to actor. And that's where it gets, people's feelings can get hurt if they have an idea for a comic moment, but the comedy's going in a different way, so they have to change it. And I think that's what makes it hard, because you can kind of get your feelings hurt. You're like, well, I think this is what I want to do here. So you have to respect that, and also respect, you know, what the script writes. You know, it's the ba-bump, 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 you know, and if any person's idea is getting away from that 3-beat setup to the punchline, you have to remember there's so many different ways to tell the same joke as long as the punchline gets the laugh. So it's sometimes you get your feelings hurt a little bit, but then you pick up and keep going and you forget about it, you know. And that's kind of what good comics do when they work together, you know, that they don't ever walk away mad.
Don't go to bed angry.
Don't go to bed angry. It's not worth it. It's not worth it. There's so many jokes to tell and so many different ways to tell them. And every idea is a great idea. It's just, what's the best idea for this? And how can we make all our ideas work? But Chris and Brian are pros. They're incredible comedians. They're very unique. We're all three very different, and yet our styles marry so well together that we just knew that the bottom line was that that's the important thing, and that's what shines through. So
I dig your tights.
Yeah.
Yes.
Unfortunately, I have to wear knee pads underneath because my knees are getting so old.
Oh, God.
But yeah.
Let's say you're given a choice in life. And you can play any part that you want. Have you replayed it, or have you yet to play it? And what is it?
Well, I don't know. There's so many plays I haven't read. You know, there's so many opportunities that I... Because I'm not one of the, I've never been one of those actors that in my spare time reads plays.
The secret's out, man.
I know. And so I'm sure there's so many parts that I should be wanting to play. And a lot of them surprise me. Like I played Barun here a couple of years ago, and I thought I'd never get a chance to play Barun. And it was a gift to play it. And it's an amazing role. But I had never read that play before doing it, and I hadn't seen the play either. So I just kind of take it. I was just over at the Rhodes Scholar discussing with them. We were talking a lot about Hamlet, because Hamlet's the one role that most young men want to play at some point. I never got an opportunity to play it, but it's just one of those that you can just kind of grab out of air and say, oh, take Hamlet, for instance. And there was a while that I wanted to play Hamlet. I don't anymore, and of course I'm too old to play it, but I did play comparable roles, like Giovanni in Tis Pity. She's a whore who's it's a fantastic Jacobean tragedy, and he's sort of John Ford's tragic Hamlet, tragic twist on Romeo, you know, tragic twist on Romeo and Juliet, because he falls in love with his sister, and his sister falls in love with him, and so, the whole concept of incest is so forbidden, and it was such a wonderful experience to play this tortured soul. It's sort of like Romeo and Hamlet wrapped up together. I can think of some that I'd love to play now, like Claudius, I think would be a wonderful, I just would love to play Claudius. He's so wonderfully wicked and mean and has to be so charismatic and believable, and there's a lot of challenges to playing that role. I was telling John, I said, I'm taking notes on Lear so that if ever I get an opportunity to play King Lear, you know, I'll have John's wonderful performance to kind of look back on and Jim's incredible direction, sensitive direction on how to do it.
I mean, that's some pretty intense stuff.
Yeah. And we were talking earlier, you know, there's a certain amount of time to play all these roles. And then you start playing like the Poloniuses and the grandpas, and the roles become fewer and far between. So I should read more plays and figure out what
your game plan is
over the next 20 years.
Mm. So. What do you suggest to somebody who's going to be embarking on a career in theater?
Yeah. You know, just to follow your passions, whatever they are. In a lot of cases, what has helped young actors out the most, in addition to the basic training, has been those skills that you have on the side. If you play the accordion, you will find yourself working in plays where they need an accordion player. If you, whatever your passion is, I mean, you know, if it's playing an instrument, or if it's, I don't know, knitting, or, you know, whatever that is, cultivate a lot of skills, regardless of what they are, because there's film and TV where they're looking for scuba divers and photographers, and if you're a security guard in your spare time and you have a full security guard uniform, or you just like uniforms and you collect uniforms, you can, you know, if you collect a basic dark blue policeman's uniform in New York, they're constantly looking for the real deal, and if you can walk in full uniform, you'll get that job. They would rather have an actor who has, and I'm just using uniforms for as an example, but if you have that, you'll get that job over an actor who can act like a policeman. There's lots of different things that you can do and cultivate in your life that will serve your acting career, in addition to learning to speak well and be able to make sense of a line of Shakespeare, which a lot of people cannot do, and
right,
they work all the time. So, you know.
At least it's not Chaucer.
Yeah, Chaucer's kind of tough.
I can't even get through that.
I know.
I'm trying.
I had to read a lot of that for my English major.
I mean, good and bad.
But you know, the Iliad, the Odyssey, mm-hmm. all of that stuff has come in great, you know, very right. handy as a classical actor, you know, knowing. But that would be my main thing. If you sing a lot, if you love to tap, or if you love any kind of dance or movement, or a lot of the newfangled dances where you pop.
You know, pop and lock.
You know, if you do that well, and you will work. Gosh, if you sing opera, you know, whatever your passion. If you sing bluegrass, Kentucky mountain music, that's your passion, you know, but cultivate your passions. If you like to cook. I know a lot of actors who bake on the side, and actually I've got one friend who, he and his wife do sort of mail order baking stuff for the holidays. So they'll come out and they do a blast every October, and we place orders, and they'll send this amazing baked basket to your family. And they do that on the side. They make more money doing that than they do as actors. And and they love doing it. So if you do web design, if you just cultivate any skill that you're inclined to, so that you're not singularly focused on just
one thing.
Yeah.
Have your safety net.
Yeah. If you DJ, there's one of the actors here who DJs down at Ed's on Sunday nights, and you know, every other or every third Sunday. And
oh wow,
you know,
should get down there.
That's a great skill. If you DJ, I mean, he can do private parties. He could do, you know. And now all you need is like a MacBook and
that's it. Crazy.
You don't have to carry around two turntables and
a
boxes
full of
LPs. You know?
No, totally. Mm-hmm. Well, great. Any last pearls of wisdom?
Oh, I don't know if I got any more pearls. I don't know. I've forgotten my pearls. They don't go with this outfit anyway.
But they're always appropriate.
Yeah, that's right. They're yeah, everybody should have a set. I think that's the main thing. Is like, if you do what you love, it will serve you as an actor. And yeah, and do as many things as you can. And, you know, come see the shows at Great River Shakespeare Festival this season. They're awesome. They're all three of them are just
amazing.
Great shows. I'm biased, but I think it's the truth. This is a great season.
It is. They're
complete works. Two Gents is the best I've ever seen.
I've seen all three shows, so I can attest to this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very good. It's
totally. Well, thanks for stopping by.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Of course.
A big thank you goes out to Chris Mixon for sharing with us today on Art Beat. More information on the Great River Shakespeare Festival can be found at www.grsf.org.
Art Beat is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. Visit us on the web at kqal.org.